Thanks, Jos. First of all, I would like to apologize for not being able to be there in person. I would also like to thank the organizers, Gina, Charlie, Mark, and Joe, for having an enormous amount of patience with me. Not only did I change my talks a couple of times when talking about the Galois survey, and I changed I want to talk about the 3D modeling that we do. Then just last week, I changed it to talk about the first stars. Then, of course, just on the weekend, I had to cancel my participation for personal reasons, which I'm really, really disappointed about, because I was extremely looking forward to this conference. It's probably the one conference I've been most looking forward to ever. So thank you very much for the patience. Anyway, so I would like to also say a disclaimer. I had absolutely nothing to do with the bomb threat on Wednesday. My talk was ready. But maybe you should have a look about Jos. He seems a bit suspicious sometimes. Anyway, so what I'm going to talk about today is finding the first stars. And this builds, of course, about several of the talks early on in the week that I've been listening into. Anna Frebel's talks, Kevin Schlaufman's talks, Birgitta's talks, and several others. So what I'm trying to do, or what we are trying to do, is to really find the first stars, or the oldest stars. And where do you go about finding them? Well, obviously, there's been a lot of work trying to find them in the galactic halo and more recently in dwarf galaxies. A lot of people have been doing that, several people in the audience, for example. But what I'm trying to convince you in this talk is that the best place to find them would be in the galactic bulge. Now, why would we do that? There are many reasons. The first one you have to keep in mind is that a lot of the work, or most of the work so far, has been trying to find the lowest metallicity stars, the lowest iron abundant stars. That is not the same thing as finding the oldest stars when you go back in time, of course. There's not a one-to-one correlation about the oldest stars and the lowest metallicity stars. And indeed, something you have to bear in mind as well is that the lowest metallicity is not the same thing as the most metal poor star. So there's, of course, a lot of stars there that have a very high abundance of carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen. So that's something that you have to bear in mind. Now, theoretically, there's good reasons why you want to look for stars that are very, very old in the galactic bulge. And there's a lot of papers over the last decade dedicated to this. This is just showing one example from this. This is a paper by Salvadori. So the bottom figure here, the bottom panel, I don't know if you can see my cursor, this shows the relative number density of extremely metal poor stars. So this is metallicity below -3. And in the galactic projection here, you'll see that the number density of extremely metal poor stars is higher towards the central regions of the galaxy rather than the galactic halo. And the reason for that is relatively simple. So the first stars would have formed at redshifts of 15, 20, or something like that. So maybe 200 million years after the Big Bang. They would have formed in the highest orbit densities. And those would have then subsequently grown with time to become centers of rather large galaxies. Now, more interesting, in fact, is looking at that higher, or the upper panel here. This shows the mean redshift of formation of metal poor stars. So any star that have formed less than -1 in this case. So if you look in the galactic halo, the typical mean formation of redshift formation is about 5 or 6 in the galactic halo. So that would have been just after 1 billion years after the Big Bang. On the other hand, if you find metal poor stars in the galactic bulge, or in the bulges of galaxies, they would have formed a redshift of greater than 10, typically, or 15, or something like that. So that means that they are really, not only would it be a good place to look for extremely metal poor stars, but they're also a very good idea to look for the older stars, even at the same metallicity. Something that you also have to bear in mind is that although they are in the bulge, they are not necessarily of the bulge. And this is something that Jason Tomlinson have been stressing in a paper in a very nice way. So they are not necessarily sharing the same evolutionary connection as the normal bulge star, but they happen to be in the bulge now. Now, why would you go looking in the bulge? Well, that's I've tried to explain to you, but it's obviously rather challenging, and nobody has really been doing this before. The main challenge is, of course, that the bulge is mostly metal-rich, and it's a very crowded region. So it's going to be really difficult to find these very rare extremely metal poor stars in the bulge. So what we it really is trying to find a needle in a haystack. So the solution, what we're trying to do, is to find a way that we can identify these stars. And it would be really convenient if they would be tagged somehow, these metal poor stars. And indeed, that's what we do. We pre-select metal poor stars based on their colors. And I'll try to explain to you in a second how we do this. The team that we're doing, this is work that I'm supposedly the PI of, but all the work really is done by Louise House. It's a PhD student here. She's on the job market, but you really have to hurry up if you want to snap her up, because she has a few job offers. But she will be finishing her PhD fairly soon. The other two people I'd like to highlight is Stefan Keller. He's the photometry guru, working with SkyMapper. And Andy Kayser, who's now a postdoc in Cambridge, who's just a general wizard about everything. And then we have a large number of postdocs that are helping out in this team as well. So it's a really fantastic collaboration. And I'm just standing by here and cheering people on. The approach that we have is a three-pronged approach. We're having the SkyMapper photometry to identify metal poor star candidates based on millions of stars. The most promising of those ones we bring to the AET and the fantastic A Omega instrument, which you can observe 400 stars simultaneously at medium resolution over a 2-degree field. So this is really perfect for doing in the bulge. You can observe many of these metal poor stars in the bulge simultaneously. It's much, much more efficient than hunting for metal poor stars in the halo, where you have to do one by one. This is a stage that we do. So far we've done about 10,000 stars. And then from that, you can then identify the most promising stars that are the most interesting that you then bring to the big telescopes. We use basically VLT and Magellan for that purpose. And so far, we've done about 50 stars. We're aiming to do 100 or 200 stars where we can detail chemistry. So just to show that it actually does work, this is the metallicity distribution function. Blue histogram here is just the raw bulge metallicity, where you don't have any pre-metallicity bias or anything like that. This is from Melissa's PhD work. So this just shows that the normal bulge distribution peaks just around solar metallicity. And the red curve, the red histogram, is what we find from our AET observations, of the, where we pre-select from photometry. And you can see indeed that we do pick up significantly more metal poor stars that you wouldn't really battle to find otherwise. You have to bear in mind that some of these extremely metal poor stars, you have to bear in mind that this is just a raw MDF. Some of these are most certainly not real for various reasons. So what we have to then do is to take these interesting objects to VLT or Magellan. And this is what we've been doing over the last couple of years. We've had we're using in a collaboration with Gaia ESOS. They observe some of our stars just for free. And we used Magellan. We had three nights last year, and I had another three nights on the VLT, and we have another couple of nights this coming year. Some of these have been published, most of them have not been published, so please bear that in mind, that some of these results are not confirmed yet. We're still working on analysis. So what's showing here on this first plot is the abundances of the alpha elements. The red dots are the ones that from the Magellan observations that we've had. The blue one is the published from the Gaia ESO. And then there's comparison with the green ones are from the bulge, more metal rich stars. And then we compare that also with the galactic halo. Most elements that we find, they show quite a remarkable similarity with the galactic halo. Okay, there may be some tendencies that the alpha elements are maybe a little bit lowish. Not very much, but on average, they may look a little bit lowish. But you have to be careful that we haven't analyzed the halo stars in the same manner. This is literature values. So we have to analyze the halo stars in the same way to really confirm or that they are really a little bit different. If you go to the iron peak elements, again, they look fairly normal compared to the halo. I know that in Kevin's talk, he talked about three metal poor or extremely metal poor bulge stars. They found that the scandium abundance was unusually low compared to the halo. We don't find anything like that. So this is something that we have to look into more, study that. Otherwise, they look fairly normal compared to the galactic halo. If you go to the neutron capture elements, indeed, our neutron capture element abundances look quite normal. This is contrast to people like Christina Chiappini, who argued that in the bulge, the metal poor stars would have a very high abundance of neutron capture element. We don't see anything like that at all. Anyway, I just point out that this is a work in progress, but we have found something like 10, 15 stars that are in the bulge that are having metallicity below -3. So the lowest one that we have is just below minus 4 in metallicity. So that's quite exciting. But the question, of course, and I've heard in previous talks and in some of the discussions, in particular after Kevin's talk, which was very nice, the question is whether these are halo interloopers that just happen to be in the bulge passing through, or whether they are really in bulge with bulge-like orbits, so they're bound to the bulge. And this is something that we've been looking at in a similar manner to what Kevin and Andy Case have been doing for their three bulge stars. And it turns out that roughly half of the stars that we have so far have orbits that are enclosed within the bulge at any given time. So they are not halo interloopers, they are really bound to within in the bulge the whole time. And indeed, the most metal poor star that we have, which is below minus 4 metallicity, is always in the bulge according to the kinematics and the orbits that we have. So these stars are really prime candidates for being the oldest stars in the universe. So if you believe the models and the theoretical predictions, let's remind you again that about 10-15% of stars that have a metallicity below minus 3 should be formed at a redshift of greater than 15. To me, that is very exciting. Now, this is model dependent, of course, but it is quite possible that some of these stars that we have found in the galactic bulge would have formed at a redshift of 15 or even greater than that, which of course would make them the oldest stars, oldest objects even, in the universe. Now, to remind you again that having a star that formed at a redshift of 15, that corresponds to an age of about 270 million years after the Big Bang. Now, wouldn't it be fantastic if you can determine the ages of these stars in another way, in a proper way? Of course, we can't use isochrones or anything like that to determine the age. We haven't found any uranium star, for example, where we can do cosmic chronology. So another way to do it would be if you can do astroseismology. And of course, there is one field in the Kepler 2 mission, which will be observed in April 2016, which will target the galactic bulge. So it would be nice if we can observe some of these extremely metal poor stars in that campaign. Now, obviously, this is going to be very difficult, and I'm more optimistic than many other people whether this even will be feasible. But I would have hoped to have been there at this conference this week to discuss this topic with the experts there, whether it is possible and what kind of accuracy in that case one can get the ages. Obviously, we cannot get an absolute age for a given star at this precision that we're looking for. But if you ever say 100 stars, maybe you can get a statistical age that gets down to this accuracy where you can get down to this level. Or at the very least, you should be able to compare with halo stars at the same metallicity if you can see that the mean age would be older for the bulge metal poor stars than in the halo, because that's really about a billion year difference expectation value. But again, that would be something that would be cool to do, but I'm not sure whether it's feasible. Hopefully somebody in the audience will be able to tell me if it is at all possible. Now, this is of course work in progress. So yes, to conclude, we have more stars that we're analyzing. We are finalizing the analysis. Luis is extremely busy doing this. We are working on improving the stellar parameters. Hopefully Gaia will help us there in a soon future, where we'll get better proper motions and distances, which will get us better kinematics, and that will be help us in order to determine the orbits better. We want to do a detailed homogeneous analysis of the bulge versus the halo to really tell whether there are abundance differences between the two. We are looking into the frequency of carbon enhanced stars, the metallicity distribution function, the calculus shape of it. Something that I also would like to do, or that we would like to do, of course, is to combine this with the work of Kevin and Andy Casey, where they have this very promising infrared selection of finding extremely metal poor stars. Unfortunately, we had already done our selection before they came up with their technique. So we had already done the observations and selected the targets. But what we'd like to do is to combine the two. And I think combining the scan map of photometry with the infrared selection that they came up with, I think that would be the most promising way of finding these extremely metal poor stars. And then, as I mentioned, it would be really cool if we can do some Kepler astroseismology with some of these objects. Well, thank you very much for your attention, and sorry that I can't be there.
You've left lots of time for questions, comments. Starting with Andy in the front row. You probably can't see him. Sorry.
Mentioned that the Kepler K2 microlensing field will contain about 500,000 to a million astroseismology measurements, and so I think it might be good to try to understand the color selection in that field. Of course, you could pinpoint other stars that are found elsewhere, but I mean they're just going to be there.
So did you say W first, or did you say Kepler? I didn't quite hear the beginning.
Yeah, so Kepler, I might have said W first because I have that on my mind, but K2 will, observe 5 square degrees in the galactic bulge, and at, -28.4 and 271. And if there should be a million stars there of order that have, half of them will be clump giants or something, which are not likely to be metal poor, but the other half will be first ascent red giants. And so it's good to target that area with pre-selection to try to understand that.
Yes. I should have also said that we're not targeting the lowest latitude fields because of the reddening is still problematic for us with SCARmapper. Now that may help if we then use the infrared selection of Kevin and Andy. But we have stayed away from the lowest latitude field, so we are from BF5 and greater.
One more. A question from Dan Huber.
Well, it's more of a comment than a question about the feasibility of the astroseismology. So Stephen Blumen and others, we've discussed it a little bit, and the main problem will be the crowding in doing the type of aperture photometry we've been doing in other K2 fields. So that will be the main tricky thing to do, and actually being able to get the astroseismology out. And we're also not quite sure yet what our detection limits are for K2, which is probably not going to be the same as for Kepler, so how far down in apparent magnitude we can actually go. But we're excited about it as well. It's just that we still have to understand the K2 data better to actually be able to say whether we can do it. And another thing which came up is that the new K2 fields campaigns 10 to 13 have been put on the website. That was mentioned earlier this week. And one of them is actually back in the galactic center as well. It's just next to the bulge field, I think. So there'll be another opportunity.